I think that we may be looking at vaccination passes that, who knows, maybe the Hillsborough Hops will have a vaccinated and an unvaccinated section. I don't know, I'm asking, but I see this as a potential problem that could generate serious consequences in violent actions and protests and things like that. Am I being nuts? What do you, and be gentle with your answer, please.
I'll take a stab at that, Rob. You know what's interesting too is I think even as restrictions get lifted, my mom and I are not going to just not stop ordering PPE. Like we're not going to just stop cleaning. So, you know, we as a business are incentivized to keep a very clean shop. We might continue with mask wearing. I don't have any intention. I think the last thing business owners want to do is get in the business of a vaccine and, you know, arbitrating who has it, who doesn't. That does not sound like something my mom and I want to deal with. However, I promise you, we're going to keep our shops very clean. And even if restrictions do get lifted, like we're going to still spend a ton of money. We're going to spend a ton of thought on how we operate. So to answer the vaccine question, I don't see small businesses getting in that business at all. I think it just would be a lot of.
Well, I have to thank you again, not only both of you, not only for your time, but people, including me, are just so tired of this virus. It's wonderful to be infected by your enthusiasm. Thank you again very, very much for being here, both of you. It was a pleasure, and thanks.
Thanks, Rob.
Appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. Go to our website, insidewashco.org, to contact us or leave comments on this interview. This series is produced by Mark Berry.
Welcome to a very special episode of both Culture in Motion and Mod Squad. We have an intersection today where we are going to talk about the music of ska and its effect on the world, as we normally do. And this is, we're also going to be talking about early ska movement and black culture with resident aficionado Mike Crenshaw.
Pew, pew, pew.
Hey, everybody.
Hello. Nice having you here today.
Good to be here. Good to meet you, Rachel. Good to meet you, Anthony.
Hey, good to meet you.
You too.
And coming in from Florida with the trumpet sounds of ska running through her always of the amazing Rachel Steele. What's up, Rachel?
Hello.
Awesome. And of course, what can I say? Anthony Robinson, the funniest dude I know.
Needs no introduction.
Knows no introduction. Mike is working on a project. Do you want to talk about your project, Mike?
Yes. Sure. I'm working on a number of projects stemming from a concept based on my life story and how it intersects with stories of others who were into the same lifestyle. And that is Black Skinhead. Black Skinhead is the working title of what was going to just be a podcast, what is a book that is developing, what will eventually be a series of documentaries, a documentary split up in a series. And there's some other stuff going on with it too. So we're developing all of it simultaneously, but one of the strongest aspects that's available for people to check out now that's in the world, in production and available, is the It Did Happen Here podcast. So if you go to itdidhappenherepodcast.com, you're going to be able to check out these podcast episodes to talk about some of the history of some black skinheads from the Midwest and how that intersects with the founding of anti-racist action and anti-fascist and anti-racist organizing in Portland, Oregon.
Well, so if some of our listeners aren't aware, that word, skinhead, mm-hmm. Really throws a fear into it. So were you hanging out with those guys who threw a chair at Geraldo Rivera, or what was that? You know what I mean? Like, because that's what I think most people think when they hear that word. You want to? Can we want to?
Reference
wanna,
right there.
Yeah, it's a. What would you say to somebody besides what you have coming up, who questions that word, skinhead, and what they, and especially like in Portland, which our KB listeners mostly live in, and. You know, with a terrible history, as talked about in the podcast you were just talking about, it did happen here. With terrible history with that word, do you want to give a little rundown of the history of the skinhead movement and how it pertains to Black people, and how it transformed into a racist emblem?
Yes, but before I do, you know, put on your seatbelts, because you're in for a long-winded answer.
Here we go. So what is ska? Get ready.
It's not Carter. I don't want to blow your socks off, right? But
the funny thing is that everybody involved in the skinhead movement has this explanation, like on a holster on their hip, because we get to say it awful lot. So
you know what's funny? Like being an entertainer, being a performer and a public speaker and stuff, there's this thing that happens where you can tell when you're losing the room. You know, even if it's just one person. And you start to see them like kind of like go into an unconscious dimension while you're talking to them. Right. And I have answered the question so many times that I have this kind of insecurity, like it's too rote, you know, and I can tell like, I'm losing the room. Well, but anyway, we're talking to people who are listening to the radio, who are on the internet. And the history of skinhead started in the late 60s in England. Okay, the term "the sun never sets on the British Empire," right? That's because the British was the world's most widespread colonial power, and they had invaded all these countries and lands all over the world. And some of those places were in the West Indies. They invaded the West Indies in a colonial imperialist mission, and they were looking to, you know, find gold. They committed atrocities and acts of genocidal warfare against the native people there, the indigenous people there. And then they participated in the slavery and the forced displacement and transport of African people, masses and masses of African people, tens of millions of African people into the Western Hemisphere, what was defined as a new world. So the West Indies, so to speak, is a place in the Caribbean Sea, between North America and South America, off the East Coast and in the west side of the Atlantic Ocean. And it is, there are islands there. One of them is Jamaica. So Jamaica was a British colony. In the late 60s, working class Black folks from Jamaica were migrating to England because they were colonial subjects looking for a better life in the financial centers of Great Britain. Okay, so when they came, they brought with them their music, their style, and their culture. And some of that music was early forms of reggae that would become, you know, roots or ska or rocksteady reggae. And when they got to England, some of the white kids that were in the working class communities took a liking to the style of these Black Jamaican immigrants, and they started listening to the music, mixing it up socially in dance halls together. And that's when British ska was born. And that's the two-tone, when you see, you know, groups like Selector and the Specials and Madness, often they're associated with this black and white checkerboard, right? And a certain style, high and tight, you know, tapered suits and skinny ties and, you know, button-down shirts and so forth. And that was a representation of the Black Jamaicans and the white British kids coming together and enjoying the music and the culture. And the style that was born from that mixture was called skinhead, because the kids wore their hair short. The Black kids would keep their hair short, and the white kids started cutting their hair like the Black kids and even putting parts in them. And that was the early expression of the movement that was, I won't say it was based on racial unity, But the fact that it was multiracial was a definite aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Would you say there was class elements in that too, right?
They were all working class people. This was not, you know, upper middle class kids might have seen it and thought it was cool and tried to get into it. But this is coming from what would be considered the hood. This is coming from the bricks. This is coming from the poor people mixing it up.
Right. And, you know, in England, you know, they are still, you know, particularly at this time, it might be a little lighter now, but I mean, the class system was still very, very much in place. And that you know, and has been since the beginning of time. So you really saw at that point probably not much different in viewed by society from immigrant workers to other dock workers. You know, I mean, there wasn't a real like now you can, now it's broken up where of course like working class people oftentimes are you know, can be against other poor people in like in our culture. But at that point the class system sort of led really the forefront of England's structure, you know. So you saw a lot of those kids with all short hair because they all worked at the docks and they couldn't have long hair down at the docks, you know, and they and you know, that all coming together really became a, you know, like a real big moment of love unity, whether it was actually real unity or not, you know.
I think more so than ideological unity, there was just the practical circumstances that brought people together. People had to work together, they had to live around each other. And if you look at the fashion of the skinhead, it's actually a utilitarian style that's got some crisp edges on top to try to make it better. You know, so you got work pants and jeans, you got work boots and work shoes, but you're gonna polish them. You know, and you're gonna press those jeans, you're gonna press those pants, and you're gonna top it off with a crisp button-down shirt and a V-neck sweater. You know,
suspenders or anything. I was talking to a friend of mine. He said that in Jamaica back in the day, anytime they would perform, they would look their best in their best suits and their ties and their white button-down shirts. And that's something that carried over when ska started becoming more popular in Britain. What else kind of is more remnant of that culture, though, that people associate strictly with ska?
So the crispness of the fashion.
Yeah.
You know, the crisp edges, the lines, the seams, the hems, the hair, the lines in the hair.
Yeah.
That all comes from black folks
who
did not have much. So when it was time to step out, we did our best.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that a handful of us have been talking about this. A lot of the Jamaican cats were influenced by R&B and soul from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the dress styles, when you look at cats like Smokey Robinson, Stats Records artists, they're all wearing the same uniform that the skinheads wore, because this is when the uniform of young black folks in the community in the urban centers in the United States who didn't have a lot of money, but when it was time to be out in public, they were going to look good. And I'll take it full circle. The first time I went to Africa, I was in Rwanda, and I was rooming at a conference with these guys who came from one of the poorest countries proportionately as far as gross national product, gross domestic product, and per capita income. One of the poorest countries in the world. They would have one pair of shoes and maybe two pairs of pants and a couple of shirts, but every morning they would polish their shoes and they would iron and press their pants and shirts. So when you saw them, they were looking better.
Mm-hmm.
They might have come over there with a whole suitcase full of stuff.
Right. Yeah, I think that I think wanting to look good is a really a representation of a lot of people who were raised in extreme conditions. Like, there's just something about that, like looking fresh and looking good, that's like such a good, strong make you feel like a real person, you know, in a world
that
particularly isn't treating people like real people, you know. And that's it's like a constant complaint by like right wing, like racists and junk like that. Like, oh, look, well, somebody's wearing like a fancy pair of shoes, or like, oh, they're spending, like, you don't understand. Like, like there's like a day that you can go out and you can, like, you know what, I'm gonna buy myself a nice pair of shoes, and so I look good, and then I can feel like a human being.
Well, also, there's a practical element to that. You can't look poor when you want to go, say, apply for a job or, you know, socialize, things like that, or at least feel good when you look poor, right? So that's why people do that a lot of times, just to be able to feel good enough to walk inside of a door and do something important. I mean, I speak from experience and observation on that. So that's part of it too. It's not just, I gotta have Jordans. It's the idea of these nice shoes are gonna help me get farther along with whatever things I'm going for in life.
Yeah, it's a measure of dignity.
Yeah.
You know, you can take a lot. You can take my civil liberties. You can try to take my human rights. But you're not gonna take away my dignity. And in a class structure where class is imposed on you, where you don't get to control your economic mobility, what do you control? You get to control the way you express yourself. Do you get to control the way you show up, you know, when you leave the house? So,
so I have a question. So there are a lot of those like fashion choices, music choices that define skinheads. Are there any like ideological like creeds or anything that define a skinhead nowadays, now that it's a little more evolved, or is it just a time period?
Again, I'm gonna start where we left off on the timeline with the original skinheads, okay? And then what happened was there was a couple of different evolutions of the movement, fashion-wise. In the 70s, the movement comes back into popularity, but right now it's interacting with the punk movement, and it almost becomes like a subcultural sect. It does become a subcultural sect within the punk movement. The punks and the skins look very different, but the economic conditions of Thatcher era England, with a lot of austerity and economic hardships on the working class, is creating a lot of rebellious youth who are saying, you know, the society is not looking out for us. They don't have our interests in mind. And so they're taken to the subcultural sex. At that point, that's also when the skinhead movement starts to divide into, you had people who were into the original two-tone movement, with different races coming together based on listening to reggae music and ska music and soul music. And then you had the emergence of the white power skinhead, because just like Trump era USA and Reagan era USA and so many other eras in Western history, you have the establishment scapegoating the immigrant, scapegoating the minority, scapegoating the poor for the country's problems. And in that context, there's always a group of frustrated white people who feel entitled to be on top, who feel their entitlement vanishing because now they don't have access to the privilege, and all they have left is violence and hatred. And so a group of those people started to become more impactful in the skinhead subculture, led by the British movement and the National Front, these far-right political organizations and politicians who were preying on xenophobia, preying on the minds of angry white disenfranchised youth, and filling that void with racism and hatred and scapegoating. So that carries into the 80s and 90s, throughout those decades in the US, where you had skinheads who were non-racist, anti-racist, more in tune with the original ethos of the culture. And then you had the white power skinheads who came into popularity here based on 80s media exposure. And again, the political economic conditions where large masses of white folks are starting to feel like their white privilege is slipping away. Who are we gonna blame? And a lot of those youth became the foot soldiers for the racist skinhead movement.
I would suggest, if anybody is interested in reading more about that era of England, read a book called Among the Thugs. I think it's Bill Buford, I believe, wrote it. And it's just kind of a story of an American who went to England during that time period. And it really kind of digs into, it's really, the book is about soccer hooliganism, you know, football hooliganism through it. But there's a bunch of chapters basically on how white power,
among the thugs,
about how white power gangs really preyed on football stadiums to that a lot of like disenfranchised white youth who really had nowhere to go were really swept up in the white power movement, because it was you know, beyond even like the political aspects and like their anger, and there were a lot of them were just sort of like didn't have a whole lot else going on. Mm-hmm. So they were really able to be like swept into these groups, which just gave them numbers, and they already had sort of like drunken violent pasts, so they were mm-hmm. they were comfortable involving themselves in drunken violent behaviors already. These were normal actions for them, and so they were able to the leaders of the groups of the National Front, the BNP, the British National Party, really were able to point a lot of those kids in a direction, you know, and
gave them something to believe in. I'll just say, you know, when I listen to you say this, give this explanation of hooliganism, right, which is basically just a bunch of white thugs, a lot of whom are going to soccer matches and attacking people, and this, you know, in spreads from England all over Europe. It's popular today, but when you describe what that element is, all you're talking about is gang culture.
Right.
But, you know, it's parallel and a reflection of and identical to what we call gang culture when we talk about Black and Latino youth in the United States.
They're blood and Crips, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, too, because as a side note on this conversation, when you brought up today's, you know, version of racism, they do gang signs now. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Very,
yeah, it's evolving, you know, gradually. You know, now they're going to start having bandanas. And actually,
they probably do, yeah.
Oh, my God. Look.
They're going to have white supremacists crip walking and, you know.
My gosh.
You see this book right here?
What's that?
This is World of Gangs, okay? I'm going to loan this by John M. Hagedorn, okay?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, this book,
this is another good one here, Settlers by Jay Sakai, right? Mm-hmm. So this is about the history of the settler. They touch on it in the World of Gangs, and in this one, it's all about the history of settler colonialism, the types of people that came over here to settle. Not the rich aristocrats, but the working class, poor, the basically thug class from Europe. Wow. So modern gang culture comes from them.
Right.
They all the stuff that the Black and Latino people wound up doing was actually started by white folks who were doing it themselves.
Wow.
Yeah, the gang, they had their own gang hand signs and their colors and all of that stuff. Because it was the white migrant, ethnic migrant classes that were in these urban centers that were poor.
Mm-hmm.
That started the modern gang culture in the United States. And it was the immigrant pop, the non-white immigrant populations had to form gangs to protect themselves.
Yep. Right, I was just gonna say that.
From the running riots, because the white people would raid the Black neighborhoods,
right,
and burn everything to the ground and massacre people.
And the police, I'm sure, did absolutely nothing about that.
Well, they're just another.
They were gangs. The fire department. They were all coming from white gang culture, actually.
Oh, wow!
I'm glad you said that, Mike, about that particular aspect. Yeah, that's very important to note.
Yep.
And it's really pretty. Like, I mean, even you could even watch something like, let's say, like Peaky Blinders is a really great example of, like, you know, whenever people get impoverished people will figure out ways to try to get themselves out of it.
Yep.
And they will, it will always be money. Is a lot of money is created by force in this world, you know, and so you know, a lot of wealth is created by force. Most wealth is created by force. So it's easy to say, well, if me and my buddies are tired of being treated like junk, let's gather together and go take some of this back ourselves, because
exactly. There'll always be a black market. So
exactly,
speak, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Or you know what, they have it and I can take it. So you know, and when we decide to step out of the quote unquote social contract, you know, it's a, it, it's a, then all of a sudden you're a gang, you know what I mean? Which it's like, and it's a word that's used to demonize a lot of groups of people who have been put together for, like you're talking about, like self-protection and things like that. So it's really not even like, I think Killer Mark said it best, in one of his episodes of his show where he said, they're not really gangs, they're more like street fraternities. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where it's like groups of people, you know?
I it's to the point where it's almost cliche to say it. Because when, you know, in a lot of the documentaries that you see over the years, you're gonna hear gangsters saying over and over again, the biggest gang is the police or the military, you know? And it's true in that a lot of these social structures and ways of self-organizing come out of a response and a reaction to the dominant forces that set these kinds of activities into motion.
Yep.
Whether it was the church, okay, or the Crusades, the Catholic Church, different forms of dominant Christianity, partnering with the aristocrats, creating private armies to go out and pillage and plunder and take control of the resources. A lot of this started in Europe when the Europeans wanted to take control of the Arab-controlled trade routes. And so they got armies together and they got their symbols and they went out to murder and to dominate and take over those trade routes and accumulate and consolidate wealth. And it's been going on ever since. That's the story of Western expansion. There's a documentary on HBO right now called Exterminate All the Brutes. Check that out. Made by a Haitian filmmaker, and it's dynamite. He explores the whole history of Western expansion and genocide that brought us modern civilization. And you're just gonna see the same things we're talking about over and over and over.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mike, what are your feelings on ska once it got towards the late 80s and 90s onward?
Early 90s, yeah. Third and fourth wave.
You know, honestly, guys, I have to confess, sometimes I have imposter syndrome as a black skinhead. Because I preferred reggae over ska. Mm.
I feel I'm a big dance hall person myself.
Nice.
Something that Anthony, something that actually I'm critical of in skinhead culture is this whole claim to be anti-racist, but we only mess with ska that happened in a certain period. And I'm like, what about the evolution of ska in the dance hall though? Y'all don't mess with that. So shout out to my guy at Box Cutter Brigade on Instagram, my guy Jabari, aka Corky, old skinhead of Chicago black skinhead. Because he put me up on this new British mashup between ska and dancehall and hip hop, right?
Ooh.
And it's this brother, what's his name? King Aggie. Have you guys heard him?
No.
Man, his music is cold. It's got the best elements of everything I love about ska and reggae, but it's like modern hip hop. And it's
very cool.
Yeah.
The early ska guys, I think that there's like, you know, a lot of people don't realize that ska itself was really like the first of like the quote unquote reggae. It wasn't even called reggae at that point, mm-hmm. you know, not until Tooth came out with Do the Reggae. And that was, you know, and that was like the dance hall of the time. And then Jamaica went through a heat wave, and they couldn't dance as fast, so they came up with rocksteady, which was more mellowed out and more taken after soul music.
I love dub. Dub is so slept on.
Yeah.
And dub, I can kind of come and go with dub because like a lot of the root stuff I don't love, but like there's some really great stuff out there, and especially like when they mix it up with like the rocksteady and the DJ stuff, like Big Youth and Uroy and stuff like that. They can really get some amazing songs in there. You know, amazing styles, and it's really like the first attempts you see at like hip hop, like mastery of music, like breaking things up and like cutting in samples of different songs and using old songs to make new songs. You know, that's pretty cool.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that without reggae, there would be no hip hop, right?
Right.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Particularly with Kool Herc, you know.
Yep.
And all of that stemmed from jazz. Like when the transistor radios came over to Jamaica, they were listening to it and they tried copying it, and then they made their own style, and that's how Ska came around.
I think that's so awesome. Even the dub plate as the instrumental B side, okay, of a record. One side has the vocals on it, one side is just the beat, you know, and that's sure. That's what Toast Over, which is the birth of MCing.
Right.
They had to keep the party moving, because the moment the party wasn't moving, that's when the trouble starts, right? So we're going to keep everybody on the dance floor and keep everyone having fun, and that's what we use this microphone for.
You ever see those old days when they would, when a lot of the guys would only have be able to afford one turntable, so they had like the other record in their hand, and they had this like one movement that they did with one hand where they could just like turn one record into another one?
Join us next week for part two of the Black Skinhead episode of Culture in Motion. Thanks again for tuning in.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in to KBOO on Thursday, April 22nd for Earth Day special programming.